right. Well, here we are. To dream again. To dare again. To feel enjoyment and happiness again. Or for the first time. To realize this is living. Be inspired. To see your life as an exciting journey of discovery. With your host of the Inspire Possibility Show, Mark Susnow.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. This is Mark Susnow, and you're listening to another show, the Inspire Possibility Show, and the show that hopefully inspires you to think differently, to think bigger, and to see possibilities that perhaps you didn't see before. And every week I invite various individuals who I consider wisdom teachers, thought leaders, who I think can enlighten us and make our day better. Today I have someone here. His name is Mitch Horwitz. He's a Penn Award-winning historian. He's the author of Occult America and One Simple Idea, History and Analysis of the Positive Mind Movement. He's written an alternative spirituality for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. And he's a vice president and executive editor at Church of Peregrine. So we got somebody that knows a lot about this, and he wrote a book about Neville, or put together, re-edited one of Neville's older books. And so welcome, Mitch.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So did I say it right about you and about Neville? And what didn't I say about Neville that...
Oh, well, I reissued Neville's first book, At Your Command, which is a very short book, and I included with it my own biographical article on Neville called Neville Goddard, A Cosmic Philosopher. So it's really two short books in one. The first part is Neville's own unadulterated words as he wrote them in 1939, and the second half is my own biographical essay and exploration of Neville's life for people who want some background on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just took a look at that, and I actually kind of made a mark here. There was a portion about, so really what he's known is he was like the predecessor to some of the teachers that are more popular today. And who are some of those teachers?
Well, he's mentioned by a couple of teachers. The late Wayne Dyer used to mention Neville, but he was really in a class by himself in the sense that his thesis was more radical than many of the positive mind teachers, and he argued for it with such elegance and such simplicity. Neville's principle was that the human imagination is God, and that all of Scripture is really an allegorical telling of your own internal development, and that whenever you encounter the words God or Christ or Yahweh in Scripture, you are really encountering a metaphor for your own imagination. And there was something so radical and so uncompromising about Neville's message that he really stood apart from most of the other folks in the positive mind culture. And he put out a teaching, he put out a thesis that was so kind of radical and without compromise that it's the type of thing that one immediately would want to argue with or start to enumerate exceptions to and say, well, you can't be serious because there's this and there's that. But if you read Neville or listen to his lectures, what you encounter is such a simple, elegant, beautiful argument. And every time he restates his thesis, there's a freshness to it so that it sounds, at least to my ears, like you're encountering it for the first time. And he was quite an obscure figure when he died in 1972. I mean, he had an ardent following, but it was really a fairly small subculture. I first heard of him for the very first time in the year 2003, and I just became hooked, and I've been experimenting with his ideas ever since. So people tend to fall into two camps. Either they have no idea who Neville is, or you know, they love him and are delighted to find that there's somebody else on Earth who feels the same way. But he's getting more
Right.
popular. I see that very directly in not only in web traffic and in his books. You know, his books are widely available in many different editions through different publishers, and they're really moving. You know, there's a very serious upsurge of interest in Neville, even more so than when he was alive. So it's quite interesting to watch.
So what I want to do is come back to a couple of things you said. One was this really what it is. I guess from reading the book, and I think what you just said, is that he kind of looks at Scripture as not historical or really
right.
not based necessarily on real characters, but it's a mythology.
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
kind of,
yeah.
did I understand that right?
Well, you could say a mythology. You know, I mean, the way he saw it, it was an allegory or a book
mm-hmm.
of symbol, really, a book of symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have said that no one in Scripture, you know, as you alluded, ever walked the earth. It doesn't record any event that ever occurred. It was written by the ancients in the form of symbol. And it really describes your own inner unfolding, which will culminate in your own realization of yourself as Christ clothed in human form. That was the story that Neville believed is found in Scripture. It begins in the Old Testament, culminates in the New, and that was his real foundation. You know, when you look at Neville's sources and references and quotes, it's almost entirely Scripture. As he got older, he brought in references to William Blake and other figures, but he believed that his books provided an illuminated reading of Scripture, and that was his real foundation stone.
But you're saying at some point he grew out of favor with his followers, and why was that?
Oh, well, something that I allude in the essay in the book, Neville Goddard, A Cosmic Philosopher, is that his message as he got older tended to focus less on what we might call mental manifestation, or what he called imaginism. And it focused
right.
more on a series of mystical experiences, sometimes really jarring mystical experiences that he had beginning in 1959. And there was a speaking agent who said to him late in his career, listen, you're going to have to go back to your message of mental manifestation and wealth creation. Your audience is shrinking, and if you don't return to that, you're going to have no audience at all. And according to a student, Neville replied to the agent, then I'll tell it to the bare walls. And that was
yeah,
Neville's outlook.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. And I place a lot of stock in that story because I've spoken to it. I spoke to one person recently whose mom used to take her to Neville lectures when she was a little girl, and she confirmed to me that towards the end of his life, she remembered there being very few people in the room. The size of the audience had dwindled, although I think that wasn't always the case. You know, it would depend upon the evening, the city, what was going on, but it seems to be a fact. And the thing I admire about Neville is that he pursued this less popular message, this message that dwelt upon his mystical experiences and the mystical experiences that he said we all would have. We all would have the experience of being reborn from within our own skull. In Scripture, Golgotha translates to skull. In Greek mythology, you have children, offspring, being born from the skull of Zeus. And Neville said that as he had experienced this, so would we all experience rebirth from within our own human skull, the seat, at least in terms of our physical perception of our imagination. So this kind of message was obviously less appealing to some people than the mental manifestation message, which Neville never fully abandoned. But he was never, it seemed to me, he was never angling for market share. You know, he was really just what he had always been, an itinerant spiritual teacher and philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
He would show up places, he would post his schedule, and you could take it or leave it. He was happy to have people come, but he was willing to have them not come. And that is so rare. People like to talk that way as if, you know, I don't care what other people think, but
right.
in terms of behavior, it's quite
right.
rare. It's quite rare. And I think Neville was a lived example of it.
You know, one thing I notice was that you kind of equated mental manifestation with, you called it imaginism. And I've actually never heard that phrase before. So,
oh, that, that was Neville's
phrase. Is that
how
you see it?
That was Neville's phrase. You know, Neville, he wasn't necessarily, I beg your pardon, yes, he wasn't necessarily disparaging it, but he was saying, look, you know, this is a part of my message that I cultivated when I was younger. It's real, it's valid, it's true, but the point of it is just to be a stepping stone to some higher realization. And he started to speak really clearly about that in the late 1960s, but, you know, some people wanted the earlier, more traditional message.
Well, what I'd like to do is kind of explore the more traditional message, because I think that people nowadays, is what they're looking for is to how to create a better reality and to visualize and imaginism, to visualize the reality that you want. He talks about that, and so many other spiritual teachers talk about that. But as we all know, you can do that, and sometimes nothing happens. And so what I wanted to do is kind of open up, you know, our discussion, because, and apparently Neville was one of the precursors to a lot of the more modern teachers, and I mean not necessarily today, but people in the last, say, 50 years. And by the way, what I found intriguing was in your commentary was that he had a great influence in Carlos Castaneda, who wrote the Don Juan books.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It was interesting. Yeah, I was quite surprised in my own research to discover that. What happened is Castaneda's wife was a student of Neville's, a very dedicated student in the late 1950s. And the way she put it, she would talk about Neville's ideas with Carlos, and most of the time Carlos seemed to express only a polite interest, sort of just a very mild interest. But,
and Carlos was a student, is that right, at UCLA?
Yeah, he was an art student at UCLA, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Those were the days, you know. I mean,
just
pre-1960s, and the whole counterculture, the whole alternative spiritual culture was just about to explode. And it must have been a very wild time, you know, but those were the days. I mean, this was around 1959, 1960. Mm-hmm. Carlos was an art student at UCLA, and his wife, Margaret Runyon, was a student of Neville's. And, in fact, the way that Margaret and Carlos met was Neville wrote a small book called The Search. And she was over at a friend's house, and Carlos was visiting, and she knew she wanted to see this guy again. So she slipped him a copy of The Search with her name and phone number in it. And that was how those two got together.
Mm.
And so Margaret would tell Carlos about Neville's ideas, and as she recorded it, you know, he expressed only mild interest, but he got very excited and very aroused when she talked about one aspect of Neville's biography in which he described being tutored by this mysterious teacher named Abdullah, who, as he described it, was African-American man, an Ethiopian rabbi, as it was later put, who was steeped in number mysticism and scriptural symbolism and Kabbalah, and the two of them studied together in the early 1930s, for a period of 5 years. And Neville said that that was his introduction to some of the ideas that he developed and wrote about for the first time in this book, At Your Command, which came out in 1939. And Margaret said that Carlos was very aroused and very excited by this backstory of Neville's, that he had been tutored by this mysterious turbaned figure. Nobody knew where this guy was, where he had come from. Was he real? Was he not real? And she felt that that might have contributed to Carlos's mythos. And I say mythos with great veneration. Carlos's mythos of having been tutored himself under a mysterious Indian sorcerer named Don Juan. Now, people in later years were angry at Carlos, or Carlos was the subject of great controversy because the forensics of his backstory didn't add up. There seemed to be no mysterious teacher and so forth and so on. But I can't, you know, get to the back of everything Carlos said, and I certainly couldn't defend him from charges of inventing his past. Wouldn't be the first time we've encountered that with a
Exactly.
spiritual teacher.
Yeah.
But I
Yeah.
do feel, I was just thinking about the first of the Don Juan books today, and I do feel very strongly that there's great beauty and wisdom in those books, wherever they came from. So I found it a sort of neat little footnote of our spiritual history that Neville apparently seemed to be an influence on Carlos, at least through the form of Carlos's wife.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. So you're saying that it's kind of accepted now that Carlos made a lot of that stuff up about Don Juan. Like,
well,
it's a fictional character.
That's certainly been the critique. I'm agnostic on the question, but I'm acknowledging that, you know, you begin to peel back the layers of Carlos's story, where he said he was from, where he said he studied,
right,
et cetera. None of it adds up. You know, at one point, you know, he had, I think, represented his own lineage and where he was from in a way that was demonstrated to be inaccurate. So, you know, clearly you don't go to Carlos's work if what you're interested in is a connect-by-numbers story of forensic truth, but you do go to Carlos's work, in my view, if especially his earliest books, if you want to participate in some ideas that are deeply alluring, deeply penetrating, and I think are possessed of authentic wisdom. There is something authentic about Carlos. There's no question about that in my mind. It's just the authenticity doesn't seem to come out in the backstory that he created for himself. Whatever details Carlos created around his life, whether he was trying to be dramatic or whether he was covering his tracks or whether he was just kind of playing some games with the reader, they don't seem to add up in the conventional sense. But in the unconventional sense, I venerate his writings, and I think there's wonderful and penetrating material there for searching people.
You know, it's interesting how they became so – it's amazing how successful they became. And, you
yes.
know, and I wonder, too, also with Neville, you're talking about this character, Abdullah, who people question whether that was a real person or not. And then
yep.
you kind of imply in your historical analysis that Joseph Murphy, who was the author of Your Subconscious Mind, which is an incredible book, he kind of more or less reported the same experience. I don't know if it with the same
yep.
teacher, although I don't know if he called him Abdullah
right.
or not.
Did
he call
did,
him
yeah.
Abdullah too?
He did. And Murphy made this claim in one place. Shortly before Murphy's death in 1981, he gave a series of interviews to a French-speaking priest who lived in Quebec. And there's the interviews were conducted in English, but they were published in French by Quebec Publishing House. That's the one and only place where Murphy speaks of his own experiences with Abdullah. He doesn't talk about it anywhere else. You know, so people have asked
and
me for years.
He mentions the name Abdullah?
Oh, yeah, specifically by name. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
And people have asked me for years, do I think Abdullah's real? Do I think it's invented?
Right.
And so I did my best to do some of the forensics on this, and I write about this in the introduction, that the biographical essay that you can find in At Your Command. And I you know, it's a mysterious matter, this question of Neville's teacher Abdullah. It's almost secondary to me whether he existed in precisely the form that's been presented to us, because again, as with Castaneda, it's the ideas that I care most about. I will say this. Everything that I found in Neville's lectures and other colleagues with mine who study Neville and are interested in Neville so far has matched up to forensically traceable facts, things that he talked about his family, his background, the circumstances of his
mm-hmm.
discharge from the military. Everything is matched up with the facts. And traceable recorded facts. I've looked at Neville's military records and other such things, genealogical records, census records, and I've never found him to say a word that wasn't verifiable. Now, The one area that I haven't been able to verify in as concrete a way has been his tutelage to this figure, Abdullah. Now, it's entirely possible that this was a real figure, and that's that. It's also entirely possible that Abdullah was a kind of composite of figures. It's also possible, and Neville never spoke directly to this, but he did speak to other dimensions of existence and reality. Maybe he encountered Abdullah in a sort of serial reality in some way, which is why people like me don't find records of him in the here and now. There's any number of things that are possible, and I consider all these possibilities, including at least one candidate for who Abdullah may have been in this essay. But ultimately, I think that it's the ideas themselves that either prove to be fruitful ground of experimentation for people or not. So, you know, that's really where I've placed my focus. But I do understand that Abdullah is a source of curiosity. It's been a source of curiosity for me. So I go through the forensics as best I'm able.
But that even comes back to, to a lot of, a lot of historical biblical things. I mean, in terms of the whole story, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and even prior to that, there are other scriptures and other cultures that kind of told, a myth about a Garden of Eden and a fall from
that's
grace.
That's exactly right.
Serpent and all this kind of the flood, and apparently that myth is another traditions.
And when we say myth, of course, it's not to be disrespecting. I mean, myth, in many ways is truer than history in that it captures psychological verites of human life. When I say myth, I say it with bended knee. I say it with veneration. Some people use the term myth to mean a fabrication, but I would never describe, the story of Icarus as being a fabrication.
Yeah,
it tells a universal story. So I think I would allow Neville and not in any way look critically or cast aspersion at Neville speaking in a mythological way about his past without saying, oh, gee, he was making something up. I feel the same about Carlos Castaneda. Again, this is the one and only area of Neville's self-description that I haven't been able to match up forensically, but I wouldn't count it as in any respect a criticism or a point against him if this was sort of a mythos that he created, similar to the things that you were just talking about. And Neville, of course, did say that Scripture was a book of symbols. So he would have said himself, the flood, the Garden of Eden, the parting of the Red Sea, these things must be understood symbolically.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, I kind of joke, I have a joke with my family sometimes when somebody does something that's, really great, one of our kids, and I kind of joke, I said, it was a miracle, not quite on the Red Sea level, but close.
Yes, right, right. I often say to people today that, if you're interested in religion in general, you can't be too neat about where your dividing line is between the traditional faiths that we're supposed to venerate and study, the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Vedic tradition, and more contemporary religious figures like a Neville or a Madame Blavatsky. People say, oh, well, Madame Blavatsky, Carlos Castaneda, they made stuff up. And my response to that is, look, every religion began with supernatural claims. There's no exception to that, whether it's the resurrection of Christ or Muhammad ascending to heaven on a white steed or Moses parting the Red Sea. That's how religions begin. And, with some extraordinary experience that's recorded by an individual or a culture and it becomes codified, the modern religions are no different. So it's difficult to draw those dividing lines and say, well, these are the serious religions, and then these guys over here are sort of sketchy. I can't draw those dividing lines.
So I want to shift direction here. Since it is the Inspire Possibility Show, I always like to ask my guests, what right now inspires you?
Oh, wow. What inspires me? There are many things that I'm experimenting with, but one of the things that I'm continually experimenting with.
I like the way you say that, experimenting. You kind of imply a lot of things.
Right. Well, everything is an experiment. I don't want to sort of speak to things as a this hardened, concretized fact, you know, and I think that we should all be careful of that, not only because it puts a brake on our own search, but there might be a day that comes where the thing that we proclaimed as hardened fact doesn't work for us, and that can be a very tough time. And that can be a very difficult time. So I do try to think in terms of experimentation. You know, with regard to Neville's experiments, he wrote a book called Resurrection, which I like very much, and which was the first book of Neville's that I read. I discovered it back in 2003. And I was thinking that for New Year's, for January 1st, I might take his book Resurrection and really dedicate myself to it for 9 months, 9 months being the period of full human gestation of a life. And he has certain ideas in Resurrection, but he talks about them elsewhere, about mental visualization and trying to enter into the emotional state, the feeling state of something that you want to see occur in the world, something that you feel morally confident would be good for you. And I want to step up my experimentation with that. You know, Neville's contention was that his method is very simple. You know, you form a mental picture. You bring it with you into a sort of relaxed state or meditative state. Mm-hmm. You try to come up with the feelings that you would really be experiencing if that mental picture came to pass. Like, let's say somebody congratulating you on a raise or a promotion or some award or achievement that is important to you. And he asks you to kind of stick with it, you know, do it, allow yourself to feel it, and then come back to reality. And he says very plainly, the things that you experience when you come back to reality are going to contradict your mental picture. It won't be there yet, but allow for it. Give it a little time. Allow for a gestation period. It will come in his teaching. I can't tell you when it's going to come, but it will come, and that's Neville's contention. And he would challenge people to test him on that. And I thought to myself, you know, no matter how long you've been studying somebody or something, it's always good to come back to the basics. So I thought, I'll come back to the basics, and I'll take Neville up on his challenge. He speaks in terms of gestation periods, you know, a lamb, a horse, a chicken, all animals, all living creatures have these gestation periods.
Right.
For a human being, it's 9 months. So why not permit myself that experiment for 9 months? So I'm thinking that's kind of what I'm preparing to do next. That's where I'm preparing to go.
You know, it's the 9 month thing, it's interesting. I had, before he passed John Bradshaw on my show, and he had just wrote a new book called Post-Romantic Stress Disorder, What Do You Do After the Honeymoon? And he came up with a 9 month period of how the honeymoon lasts for 9 months, which is the same thing as the gestation period. You know, it was a fascinating interview.
That's very interesting.
So that 9 months, but I like that idea. So what is it so for you? What is that mental image of you? It's going to be in all the different areas of your life, like your personal life, your professional life. Just do you have a particular image, a thing you're working on in particular for next year?
I do have some things that I'm working on, and some of them are just too intimate and too personal to share. But there's things
you're
that
forgiven.
Everybody would recognize.
You're forgiven.
Yeah, right. There are things that everybody listening would recognize. We're not all radically different. We have different interests in different areas in which we live our lives. But you know, there are things that I think everybody could relate to. But one of the things that I struggle with in Neville's work, and one of the areas where I'm trying to get more clarity, frankly, is the question of ethics. The question of ethics. You know, one thing Neville would say is that if you accept his proposition that the human imagination is God, he would say, look, then your desires are God-given, and what you want, the very fact that you're experiencing a desire in itself speaks to its rightness. In itself speaks to its rightness, because if your mind is that of the Creator, if your mind is the mind of God, you're not going to have, by definition, you're not going to have desires that are corrupt. At the same time, At other points, he talks about the fact that, yes, you know, you can manifest things that might be destructive, or yes, you know, you might be manifesting something that wouldn't be good for another person. And if you're wishing something, for example, for another person, that they wouldn't be able to wish, that they wouldn't be able to subconsciously accept, then the projected thought returns to you. So that was his kind of own theory of karma or reciprocity. And if Neville were alive, that would be the discussion I would want to have with him, because I don't find sufficient clarity in his work, you know, on questions of ethics. You know, on one hand, he says, just having a desire in itself is a communique from the higher, from God, since your mind is rooted in God. But then other times he talks about the possibility that a desire might be something that's right, unsound, that might bounce back to you. Now, my perspective is we have been given ethical guidelines in this life. The Beatitudes are a wonderful ethical guideline, maybe the most sublime that's ever come down to us. So it seems to me that even if one views Scripture as a work of symbolism, it still seems to me very clearly that there are ethical guidelines there. I would want to put that question to Neville. I feel that's
right,
an unfinished thread in his work.
So we're going to have we're running out of time here, and I'd love to continue this conversation. I know we're going to have another conversation next month about somebody else, about
right,
Maxwell Maltz and psycho-cybernetics.
Right.
But I want
right
to thank you for being my guest on the show. It's
thank
very
you
fascinating, very enlightening, and to have someone with your wisdom and knowledge and dedication. So I thank you for your commitment and dedication to the work that you're doing and the work
thank
that you bring into the world. And people can get your book at probably, what, most of the medical bookstores, or certainly on
anywhere,
Amazon,
anywhere
right
at all. Yeah, that struggling little online retailer has it. And anywhere you buy your books, you can find a copy of
right
At Your Command. If you want to find me, just put Mitch Horowitz into Google. I am super easy to find. It'll take you right to my website.
Perfect. All right. Thanks again so much for being our guest on the Inspire
thank
Possibility
you
Show. And in the
enjoyed
meantime,
it
journey on.
You've been listening to Inspire Possibility Show with Mark Susnow. To learn more about Mark Susnow, go to inspirepossibility.com and click on the contact button. Schedule a complimentary visit with Mark or email him at mark@inspirepossibility.com. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine.